History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media. MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
Well, there's plenty to worry about in our sector of the national security world, per usual. But first, there came news yesterday that really made me laugh. And that is the story of David Rush, a former senior CIA officer with a top secret clearance, who has been arrested on charges of secretly stashing $40 million worth of gold bars in his home that he said he needed for, quote, work-related expenses. Now, one thing that really caught my eye in that story that was that he passed the so-called lie detector or polygraph test, showing once again that these things can be beaten by a skilled, dedicated liar, Aldridge Ames.
I think Beth Scanner was on CNN last night and said after she looked at the court papers on this that she concluded the guy was a pathological liar because that's the only way only way you could pass a polygraph.
Yeah,
that you're a
You can't do that if you're timid. You have to be a skilled liar like Aldridge Ames, almost a criminal mind. It reminds me of that movie, 2002 movie with Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Hanks, you know, the guy who reinvented himself in a million ways. But, you know, they didn't double check his academic credentials.
But they didn't
double check his military record.
Yes. Until he was getting ready to retire when they apparently caught it. But the mind-boggling thing to me is he says he got this as work-related expenses. So now he's a covert op, so I understand, you know, you in that business, you have to pay people for information. You have to induce them in many different ways. But 303 gold bars worth $40 million plus $2 million in cash, like, is there some accounting system at the CIA for covert ops?
Yeah, is there some accounting system for gold bars? But here's the thing. I queried some of my covert action veteran friends, and they said, not likely for espionage reasons, for kind of obvious reasons. If you've suborned a secretary in the IRGC to as a spy for us, for example, you're not going to pay them in gold bars and so on. You have to do that in very unobtrusive ways that would not draw attention. One of my former CIA friends said it was mostly involved in a criminal kind of enterprise, either infiltrating a criminal enterprise like narcotics and so on, or being a criminal yourself and wanting to get involved in a criminal exercise. But a lot of questions.
But Jeff, what's your ultimate takeaway from this? I mean, that, this was a fluke. Oh, my goodness, we need to review. I mean, we really need to think about this in terms of the larger system.
I like everybody has had to file expense account at various times, and somebody reviews them. I'm just trying to imagine what the expense account system was within the CIA, and they're seeing millions of dollars
in
gold bars.
Mistakes were made. It's in the past.
No, mistakes are constant. This show shows that mistakes can be made and may still be going on.
And are still being made.
I mean, who knows whether we will find some co-conspirators. And, of course, these charges against him, which are quite minor, really, right now, they could be there can be supplemental charges coming in as the investigation proceeds. But, boy, you know, it's just slovenly administration. Let's put it that way. Anyway, let's move on. Cash Patel, back in the news, fires another senior official for flimsy reasons, it seems to me, a senior analyst who wrote the report on the shootout at the Republican baseball game a few years ago. And she investigated and wrote it up as, you know, a one-off, another crazy guy who, as she put it, was committing suicide by cop. It was not an incident of domestic terrorism. But of course, because it was directed to Republicans and Cash Patel and Trump are on this campaign to root out everything, you know, she's getting fired because she wrote it wasn't domestic terrorism. And, you know, they're on the warpath to label anybody, any liberal groups, any group or individual opposed to Trump as
well. I got to say, it does strike me as domestic terrorism. The guy was there with a political motive to shoot and kill Republican congressmen. If that's not domestic
not a
terrorism,
domestic terrorist.
It's not a domestic terrorist?
No, it's a one-off. These self-starters.
What do you mean?
We've had guests on in the past.
I'm sorry.
We've talked about these being the greatest threat, a security threat in America is these one-off guys. They are not terrorists.
But
they're
we
nuts.
Label them terrorism all well, the time. And in fact, the FBI ended up labeling this domestic terrorism.
So what kind of road do you go down?
Because this is exactly one of the really dire things that's happened since 9/11, which is the making way common and diluting the word terrorist and what it means. Does it mean belonging to a cell? Does it mean having, you know, international ties? We've debated this in Congress and in the White House now for more than two decades. And what happens now is that domestic terrorism is used for anybody who does something. And we're worried about who also says something that criticizes the government. So
the made up Antifa threat.
So it is. This is a long, slow slide that's been happening for a long time, and without any kind of ability to stop it, it sinks. And we've talked about this before on the show. It's headed in a bad direction.
Yeah, we've had experts on the show talking about this. If you start, you know, turning these nutballs into like the guy who shot up the Correspondents' Dinner and so on, and the guy who showed up with a gun outside the White House gate last week, and you start calling them domestic terrorists, you're saying all Americans are potential terrorists. I mean, if you can't differentiate the difference between Al-Qaeda and opponents of Trump, then you've lost your whole intelligence.
Wait. He's not an opponent of Trump. It's a guy who went to a baseball game with the intention of shooting and killing Republican congressmen.
Suicide
by cop. That's a political motive.
No,
we define terrorism as acts of violence in furtherance of a political end.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I think this meets the test.
But the real question is, what does this mean legally? Does it, you know, you could call them whatever you want, but do you prosecute them for terrorism? Which, you know, how are you going to do that? Are you going to?
What do you mean? We have laws.
We have laws that you can prosecute for certain kinds of material support, et cetera, et cetera. Right. Much of it is based on sort of older structures that had to do with international ties, et cetera, group affiliation, swearing allegiance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is that we've so expanded this category that when it happens, even when it looks like terrorism, we have to really rethink about the fact that we have not defined the term. You think you've defined it, and that's fine. And it is there in some laws here and there. But we have a very opaque, large, vast use of the word terrorism that we are not using.
Well, this gets to the question: is should we have a domestic terrorism law?
Yes, and the answer is no.
Debated for some time.
We could, and we have an answer, so we don't even have to debate it. The answer is no.
Right. Yeah. I'm with you, Karen, and you're voted off the island.
All right, not for the first time.
What else? China. You know, we have the Trump summit. during which he got played like a mouse by a cat in the form of Xi Jinping, it seems to me. And he sort of dismissed the idea that of Chinese espionage, was massive espionage directed at the United States. And now there's word that China is training. Listen to this. China is training police forces in many developing countries. Since 2000, it has held nearly 900 training sessions, including on counterterrorism, riot control, and border control for at least 138 countries. Now, this seems to me a strategic threat to the United States. Karen, you're leaning in on that.
Well, I just think it's if you understand how the Chinese have decided to deal with the world at large over the past two decades, and you look at Belt and Road, which basically, was helping build infrastructure, developing ties with communities, et cetera, it's not surprising that this would be one step more. It's a question of where can we become valuable and in some cases invaluable to other communities, peoples, countries, and at the same time, and I don't think this should be minimized, create a sort of bonds and ties that will be important in the future, depending on what the political circumstances turn out to be.
It's a soft power issue, and we've wiped out, eliminated, literally, the U.S. Agency for International Development, which used to be running some of these police training programs and so on. We're on our back heel on this Ebola crisis because of that. Kash Patel has been firing counterintelligence agents because they got on the wrong side regarding some Trump investigation and so on. What a mess. Let's move on to our guest, Tommy Vietor, who was a White House national security spokesman and special assistant to President Barack Obama. He went on to become a co-founder of Crooked Media with fellow veterans of President Obama's speechwriting team, Jon Favreau and Jon Lovett. And he co-hosts the wildly popular Pod Save America, Pod Save the World, and other pods. He also co-authored the New York Times bestseller, Democracy or Else, with Favreau and Lovett. The book addresses the central question, how do you get involved in the political process and make a real difference without losing hope or your sense of self? It breaks down the process into actionable steps from basic voter education to running for office. And so we're bringing Tommy on to talk about how to re-engage Democratic voters on foreign policy and national security issues. And without further ado, let's do that right now. Tommy Vietor, welcome to Spy Talk. What a pleasure to have you here. Now, you're leading a movement to develop a new foreign policy for Democrats.
Oh, no, am I?
Well, that's what the publicity
That's why we're having you on.
Hey, I'll take it. I'll lead that movement.
Well, would I be wrong to assume what that really means is getting back to the old traditional foreign policies that served us pretty well since 1945, strong support for NATO, countering China? What about the so-called forever wars, which President Obama inherited and continued in Iraq and Afghanistan? Then there's the Iranian porcupine. So what's going to be new about your policies and how to get Democrats energized and motivated to develop a new foreign policy?
Well, I mean, look, I think, first of all, thank you for having me. I would in no way describe myself as someone who is trying to lead a new foreign policy consensus or push some new dogma or set of ideas. I think I'm someone who worked in the Obama administration, saw a lot of things in DC that were broken, that were, many of them were partisan, many of them were bipartisan problems. There's sort of a, Ben Rhodes famously called them the blob. It is this, kind of permanent class of foreign policy thinking that often leads to using the U.S. military to solve diplomatic problems. For example, I think has led to an over-reliance on sanctions, even when the end goal of those sanctions somehow never gets accomplished, but we are crushing the economies and, populations of countries like Cuba, for example. And I think people just want to get back to something a little more common sense, less militaristic, and more focused on core U.S. interests and not, whatever Trump is doing now, the new Don Road doctrine, where we are apparently the emperor of the Western Hemisphere.
Democrats have a pretty bad brand, as widely reported. Mm-hmm. So how do you reformulate these ideas to catch the electorate's interest?
Well, I mean, look, I think the idea that, you know, the part that is most animating the Democratic Party right now is U.S. foreign policy towards Israel. It's the war in Gaza. It's the war in Ukraine. And I think in many ways that should be the easiest. I mean, I think you're just trying to right size the U.S.-Israeli relationship and make it more in line with the U.S. relationship with, say, France or any other country in the world. I think most people, when you learn that the U.S. has provided Israel with over $300 billion in aid, mostly military aid, since 1946, they think that's kind of bonkers. As you all know, one of the second highest or third highest recipients is Egypt, and most of that money is contingent on making peace with Israel. So that's a lot of dough. And then on top of that, you have all kinds of additional emergency funding for programs like the Iron Dome. You have, you know, you direct U.S. military action in defense of Israel in the war with Iran. And then there's all this diplomatic support for the Israeli government. And I think what people are just saying is, hey, Israel's a rich country. They probably don't need $3.3 billion a year from us. U.S. military sales should not come with no strings attached, should not be given to units that commit human rights violations or to annex the West Bank. Or just, you know, providing blanket cover at the UN, even when it's in contravention of U.S. policy. So that, those are the sorts of things I think Democrats are talking about.
Well, let me, you know, Tommy, you say that was this is the easy part. And, you know, I haven't. Senator Van Hollen had this quite provocative op-ed in the New York Times the other day, which your Pod Save the World co-host, Ben Rhodes, approvingly tweeted to the world. And I got to say, when he actually laid out what the Democratic policy should be, it was a lot more complicated and problematic than I think you're presenting and most people have thought. He writes, Democrats should pursue Alaska gas effort to salvage two-state solution. If that fails, the United States will have to consider other options to secure equal political and legal rights for all. And he goes on to say, the next Democratic president should recognize a state of Palestine that is subject to clear benchmarks, including free and fair elections. Unless and until a different agreement is reached, the United States should treat Gaza and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, as part of Palestine. Now, is that what you have in mind and you guys, Ben Rhodes, the rest of you have in mind? And if so, I'm just trying to imagine how exactly that would work. What government in Palestine would the United States be dealing with? And if the Israelis refuse to evacuate the West Bank, who's going to expel the Israeli army, not to mention 700,000 Israeli settlers?
So I read the op-ed too. I mean, I'm not going to say that I've sort of ascribed to all of Senator Van Hollen's views or have dug through all the specifics of his proposal, but I think he is more in line with where most of the American people are on foreign policy than you know. Look, I think
so. Answer my question: how does this work in actual practicality? Who are you going to deal with? I mean, Hamas in Gaza. I mean,
let me step back. I think what people are getting at is the two-state solution is bullshit, and it's dead, and it's been dead for decades, and it's a thing politicians in America say they support in lieu of actually doing something. We say, oh yeah, right. Well, the two sides need to talk. And everyone knows there's no chance in hell that's going to happen. Bibi Netanyahu brags about his efforts to kill off a two-state solution. And that was before October 7th, which hardened populations in both areas. So I think people are trying to say, okay, the status quo is terrible.
Agreed.
The status quo is driving terrorist attacks and Hamas and violence against Israelis and killing Israelis. And the status quo is leading to life being hell on earth for the Palestinian people, especially people in Gaza. So what's an alternative view? I think what Senator Van Hollen is talking about is being realistic and using a carrot and a stick approach when it comes to Israel and not doing what Joe Biden did and what Donald Trump did, which is give a blank check to everything Bibi Netanyahu wants, no matter how many kids he massacres with the bombs we are giving to him, and not put any pressure on their side to make concessions. And a two-state solution is going to require concessions. A one-state solution or recognitions of a Palestinian state is going to require concessions. Why can't we talk honestly about that?
Well, yeah, but I mean, the question is, who's going to make those concessions and under what terms? I mean,
you're just conceding the West Bank is going to be Israeli? Like, I realize it would be hard to expel those settlers.
No, I'm not conceding
it
at all, but I'm just saying, I just want to see how you get from where you want to go to there. And I don't see it. I mean,
I don't see it either. It's really hard. It's brutally difficult.
Yeah, I'd like to step back, I think, before we get to how do you implement, you know, recognizing Palestine. I mean, how do you get, I mean, if Social Security is the third rail of American politics, you know, Israel is the fourth rail, right next to the third rail. How do you get, I think is more to what you're doing, how do you get the people to even talk about these issues in a way that some energetic and innovative policy discussions can even occur?
I think that Israel and these policy issues used to be a third rail, and it used to be a thing in DC where you had to, you know, play within the 40-yard lines or else you'd never advance to get another job. The American people, since the war in Gaza started, have moved in a very different direction. Anyone under 40 has only grown up with Bibi Netanyahu as the prime minister of Israel. They have seen him come to the U.S. to undercut a Democratic president and his efforts to make peace with Iran. They have seen his repeated bombing of Gaza and the overreach there. And so there's an enormous amount of cynicism towards that relationship. And I think you're starting to see people wake up to that. I think like the Democratic Party, the establishment, the elected officials have moved unbelievably quickly when it comes to conditioning aid to Israel, possibly cutting off military sales or support. But they're still not where the base of the party is. And I also think disconcertingly, you're also seeing the far right of the Republican Party moving to this place quickly, but with some messaging from some really dark places, you know, some like neo-Nazi fringe people like Nick Fuentes. And I think to the point you're getting at is when we don't have an honest conversation about the realities on the ground, the leaders involved, and when people get told, you know, it's anti-Semitic to single out Israel or criticize the country, you know, like under the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, that's when you push that conversation to these fringes and you elevate those voices. Those are the things that concern me.
Well, speaking of fringes, one of your other co-hosts, Jon Favreau, did a long interview with Hassan Piker recently. Mm-hmm. Hassan Piker, who said that Hamas is 1,000 times better than Israel and 9/11, and America deserved 9/11. Is that a voice and a perspective that should be part of the Democratic Party debate on foreign policy?
He is a part of the Democratic Party foreign policy debate. And so I think we should work with the world as it is, not some sanitized version that we might want it to be. Hassan has apologized and walked back the U.S. deserved 9/11 point. I think what he was trying to talk about is the concept of blowback, which is something you all know very well, which is that foreign policy decisions can lead to the growth of groups like Al-Qaeda, which can lead to horrible things. I don't think that's blaming the United States to say that. I totally disagree with him that Hamas is 1,000 times better than the IDF. I think he was trying to make a point in a, you know, like hyperbolic way about the death toll when you total it up. Again, I think Hamas is a horrible organization. I think they have done more harm to the Palestinian people in Gaza than almost anyone. And what I would want to do would be to empower the Palestinian Authority and other groups to, you know, have a more serious diplomatic conversation. But I think what Hassan is speaking to is what I was talking about earlier, which is like the outrage people feel waking up in the morning for the last several years and seeing the IDF bombing, you know, a camp in Gaza or, you know, killing another kid. Like that is radicalizing for people. And I think Hassan is speaking to how people feel.
So one of the things that you focus on in a number of ways is educating the American public, educating politicians, both, right? Like what would be viable both in terms of policy and practice, but also what would be viable in terms of what we're going to get people to vote for. And so what I'm interested in that lane is there's been a lot of talk about the Democratic Party moving to more progressive international, you know, global policy. Can you just talk to us a little bit about how you see what that progressive movement is? And it doesn't have to be just in the context of Israel.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think a lot of it is frustration with just decades of endless war and using the United States military to solve diplomatic problems. And this is where, like, hand up, I worked in the Obama administration, and I think we made this mistake too. And I think that there's a long tail from some of those mistakes. I mean, look at the war in Libya and the way that the outcome there has spilled out into Northern Africa and parts of the Sahel. And, you know, like, it led to a series of coups. You know, so, like, those are the sorts of things I think people are worried about. I think one thing that I think drives a lot of people crazy is that diplomatic deals seem to get more scrutiny and pushback than wars, right? Like, the JCPOA was nitpicked to death. Even Democrats that I like and respect still start every sentence about the JCPOA talking about its flaws and its limitations and this and that. We need to talk about the world as it is and the alternative, which is this catastrophic war that we're watching right now, where, you know, maybe the best case outcome for Trump is a JCPOA-like deal at the end, but, like, look what we went through to get there. So it's talking about those kinds of things. It's talking about a renewed focus on human rights, for example. At the very least, just sort of, like, not being this kind of malign force at times in the world.
Yeah. Has there, just to follow up a little bit on that, because in order to have new ideas and not people who will nitpick the JCPOA to death, to give you an example, and you focus on this, you do need new voices. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering how you think about finding the younger voices who are in or out of politics. They could be policy people, you know, experts in one way or another, working at some think tank. Or do you think about, wait a minute, we need new voices. We need to think about who are the leaders of the future, who's going to be, you know, the Wendy Sherman of the next generation. Mm-hmm. What's happening in that area?
Well, when it comes to, like, the finding the next Wendy Sherman, I think that's going to be really challenging because of all the cuts to the State Department and all the pushing out of all these brilliant career foreign service officers who were just, you know, demoralized and had their remits cut. You know, they were pushed out in the first Trump administration. They're getting pushed out again. So building back the foreign service is going to have to be a huge priority of the next administration. You're also going to have to build back some new iteration of USAID. You know, look at what's happening now with this Ebola outbreak and the harm it's doing to our ability to provide, you know, health services, screening, you know, intelligence on where it's spreading. I mean, right, it's a catastrophic disaster, and there will be some thinking there. I do think there are some young, progressive, really impressive voices on foreign policy in Congress right now that people can look to for leadership. Someone like Yasmin Ansari, Maxwell Frost down in Florida. Like, there's a bunch of young, smart, progressive thinkers. Sarah Jacobs is doing a lot of great work trying to put pressure on the UAE over its role in funding the civil war in Sudan. So I think the voices are there. The question is just, like, how do you get them heard and elevated?
You're an expert on communications. You're a leading expert on communications. So, you know, as is often said, elections are what people vote on, their bellies or their stomachs, yeah, you know, their well-being and so on. How do you make a connection between, you're also a national security guy. So how do you make this connection to voters between national security disasters or these forever wars and people's well-being? Is there a road into that, you see?
I mean, I think at the moment you drive them to any gas station and you point up, right? I mean, that part is sort of is being made clear right now to people. I think that people inherently know that the U.S. hasn't gotten a lot of value out of the post 9/11 wars. You know, I mean, again, I say this with humility, like, is the threat from Al-Qaeda or ISIS diminished since 2009? I don't think so. I think it's metastasized and spread and is a more complicated question. So I think people are furious about the price tag. I mean, I think, what does Brown University say? The price tag has been all in, like, $8 trillion from the post 9/11 wars when you consider the veterans benefits and things. I think it's a conversation like, imagine if we had spent that money elsewhere. Now, Donald Trump, I think, really effectively harnessed that sentiment. He ran on not making these mistakes. He hired people like Tulsi Gabbard, whose reason for being was preventing the next regime change war. And then he completely went against his campaign promises. So I think that will be a potent message for someone, both in the Democratic Party, but also in the Republican Party, You know, you could see someone like Tucker Carlson running a fully isolationist campaign.
Do you see anyone at the national level that fits your ideal for the kind of candidate who can grasp the national imagination for the Democrats on these issues?
I mean, I think Van Hollen's shown some really impressive leadership. You mentioned him earlier. I think John Ossoff down in Georgia is doing an excellent job, I think, talking about complicated foreign policy interests, but also connecting it to your own life and talking about corruption in the way autocrats, you know, fuel autocratic movements through corruption. I think he's been really impressive. So there's a bunch of folks out there in the party. It's just, it's not clear at all who's going to decide to run in 2028 and kind of get that megaphone.
Not clear at all.
So let's talk about Iran a little bit.
Sure.
I think, you know, we can all agree that whatever Donald Trump had in mind when he started this war, it's led to a much more hardline regime in Tehran, led by the IRGC. Now, I watched your Pod Save the World show the other day. Mm-hmm. You were talking about where we are today, and I should point out that, you know, this is Thursday. Axios is reporting yet again a deal has been reached but hasn't been signed, so let's put that aside for the moment.
Memorandum to make a deal.
I mean, whatever,
it's a non-starter,
but I mean, the fact is the Strait of Hormuz is still closed.
Yeah.
Oil isn't getting through. This is causing catastrophic consequences around the world. And I heard you say it's horrible that people in Asia are starving as a result of what's going on in the Strait. So let's just say that the IRGC and Trump don't reach a deal on opening up the Strait, and this continues. At which point, what is the alternative? I mean, and, you know, there are those, including Tom Friedman, who said we need an international armada militarily to go in and clean up the Strait, because otherwise the IRGC has the entire world hostage to, you know, on the oil. What's your view? If there is no deal, what is the next step?
There is no next step. There is no international armada. What the hell is Tom Friedman talking about? We have the biggest navy in the world. Do you think the Chinese are going to help out with
this? Okay, so unilaterally? Should we
in every war game we have played on this, the fleet has been sunk.
Mike, the only option is a deal. The problem is Trump's ego. He's going to need to eat some shit and have some FDD in the right-wing hawks in Washington.
Well, he's
going
to have to do that anyway.
That is the only option. He is going to have to cut a deal with Iran that he could have had without a war and be told that his deal was potentially the same or weaker than Obama's. And boo-hoo to him if his political standing takes a hit. But that's the only option on the table. And if I was Iran, what I would do is I would trade over the so-called nuclear dust. It's highly enriched uranium, by the way. It's not dust. And make that the thing that I give up in return for some sort of sanctions relief or unfrozen assets, and some sort of JCPO-like agreement to limit enrichment that will have all the problems that people whine about today in terms of the sunset provisions and this and that. And it doesn't include ballistic missiles, and it doesn't include support for proxies. But that's the problem with living in a reality-based community. We have to sort of operate in that framework, right? And like that's sort of why the nitpicking of the JCPOA drives me crazy, because people act like Iran, there was some deal on the table where they would have given up their nukes, their ballistic missiles, and their support for proxy groups, when that was just never, ever, ever going to happen. And Trump is now like, he's touched the stove and he's getting burned, and he's going to just have to eat it politically one way or the other.
More than burned, he's maneuvered us into a strategic defeat. A fifth-rate power has boxed the world's strongest military into a box.
Yep.
And the question is how we get out. I worry that this emotionally bent president, who runs totally on the fumes of his ego, will try to reach for a nuclear weapon as a way to solve this issue. Does that worry you? And how do you think the chain of command on nuclear weapons would react if the president, like Nixon's aides were worried about him starting, nuclear war. Do you worry about the chain of command under Trump that it would actually allow him to drop a nuclear weapon of any size on Iran?
I do worry about that. I mean, one of the reasons I worried about it was because all of a sudden Tucker Carlson started talking about this question a lot. His suggestion that Trump's rhetoric was kind of trying to pave the way for some sort of nuclear use.
That's what I heard too.
Yeah. And so I think there is this, I of course I think they would follow orders. I mean, I think that's what the military does, and they have purged.
I don't know. Trump has punted time and again about resuming the military.
He doesn't want the war to keep going, for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, he threatens to bomb power plants and bridges, and then he, backs off. I mean, so I'm not quite sure that that's,
I'm not arguing that's a likely option, but like, is there a 5% chance? Absolutely. Some psychopath from FDD or one of these think tanks that somehow has credibility in Washington gets into his office and says, sir, finish the job with a nuke. Or Bibi Netanyahu comes and does another PowerPoint where they float Ahmadinejad as the next president of Iran, or Reza Pahlavi, or some other utterly fanciful, moronic proposal that involves first, taking out the IRGC with a nuclear weapon. I mean, like, crazier things have happened.
Do you know, speaking of Israel and nuclear weapons, can you talk at all about the relationship between Israel and nuclear weapons and the United States? Can Israel unilaterally attack Iran with a nuclear weapon?
I have no idea. I sure as hell hope not. I mean, that would be a big step. Netanyahu has done a lot of crazy stuff to stay in power and,
indeed,
hunt elections down the road. I hope he wouldn't go there, but they have nukes, so.
Okay, this is turning very, very scary. I'm going to try to ask something that's less, sure, less scary, and then you could come back to the scary stuff. Okay, guys? I'm curious, when you're talking about this amongst yourselves and with former Obama officials or even Democratic politicians, where the discussion with the international powers comes into play. Are there informal outreach that you know of to international players that are not going on with the administration, but they're going on behind the scenes? And if so, how can that prove constructive going forward?
That's a great question. I wish there was more of that. CPAC, you all remember, CPAC, the conservative conference every year in DC, 15, 20 years ago, was seen as kind of like the bar scene in Star Wars, the fringe crazies kind of getting together and having an event.
Now they're in office.
Now it's the base. Now it's MAGA. And so they've not only has CPAC been successful, but they've also franchised it. You'll see like CPAC Hungary or CPAC Argentina or, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that the left would benefit from more sort of like connective tissue. And that doesn't have to be like, super hard left. It could be, social democratic parties, social Dems in various countries getting together, labor, et cetera. I think there should be more of that. There should be more conversation, cooperation, coordination, trading of best ideas and best practices than there currently is. I think it's constructive, but there's just not really that much of it that I'm aware of. There's conferences and things, but there's just not that much.
Do you think that the other powers in the world see it the way you do, which is that Trump has to make a deal and it's on Trump to do it, as opposed to some kind of larger coalition deal making?
Yeah. Every single report I've read is that.
Yeah.
I mean, the Keir Starmer said, absolutely no, we're not going to help out. The French are overtly rejecting, any calls to be a part of an armada that helps boats get through the Strait of Hormuz. The Gulf countries reportedly were begging Trump to end the war, and then he told them they had to be in the Abraham Accords, which is just insane. So yeah, it does seem like there's pretty much unilateral agreement that, or universal agreement that, this is a bad idea.
I want to get back to talk to about the kind of audience you have, and if you're resonating at all with these young white, less than college degreed males who are turning away from Trump. But first, we have to step away for just a minute. Okay, we're back. Tommy, are you getting any audience feedback from former MAGA types who call into your show or interact with you at all?
Self-described MAGA types are probably pretty far gone. I think if you're calling yourself MAGA, you're basically saying, I'm in the cult, pour me some Kool-Aid, let's do this. There are definitely disaffected Republicans, kind of former like Romney Republicans, who would often tell us that, you know, we would listen to Pod Save America and Ben Shapiro, for example. Maybe there's some hate listeners. I don't know. It's most of the feedback, unfortunately, comes on social media, which is, as you all know, not the friendliest place.
let's talk Cuba.
Yes.
A bit. You know, the president you worked for famously opened up relations mm-hmm. with Cuba, flew down there, went to a baseball game with Raul Castro. This president, obviously, has taken a very different tack and has indicted Raul Castro, notwithstanding that he's mm-hmm. 94 years old. As you look at it and where things are today, I mean, you can look at it a couple of different ways, but Cuba appears to be a completely failed state. There's been no reform by the Cuban government, both political or economic. They seem, you know, wedded to their rigid Marxist orthodoxies. First question is, what should be the democratic approach at this point to a failed state like Cuba, 90 miles from our shore?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first question is, yes, it's a failed state. But I mean, how many decades are we going to try a failed policy, I think, is the bigger question. I think is the kind of thing you hear from people who are not necessarily in D.C. or foreign policy experts when they talk about the U.S. and Cuba. What possible threat could this tiny little impoverished island 90 miles from Miami pose to us? It's all just like the dumbest legacy Cold War stuff, in my view. And so you tell me if you disagree. I feel like all the lights are flashing green that Trump is preparing some sort of Venezuela-style regime change operation. There's the Raul Castro indictment. There's sanctions. There's all these intelligence overflights. There's, you know, John Ratcliffe, the CIA director, going to Cuba to present what sounded kind of like an ultimatum. I mean, that seems to me where this thing is trending. Do you disagree?
Yeah, I mean, look, we had this conversation last week about Cuba and, you know, was Trump going to do a Maduro-like operation to seize Raul Castro? I think the optics of seizing a soon-to-be 95-year-old who's no longer in power is a lot different than a leader like Maduro.
Yeah.
So I don't see that in the cards. What strikes me as more of Trump bluster, much like Iran, threaten, bluster, and hope somehow it leads to something positive. And it could. I mean, look, I mean, the Cuban ambassador to the UN has said, we're open to talks, we're open to doing some reform. And that's clearly in response to Trump's pressure campaign. So,
but in the interim, we're starving an island to death.
Yes.
I mean,
Thank you.
People have no power for 23 hours a day. You can't cook mm-hmm. food. You can't go to the hospital. Yeah. Like, kids are going to be permanently malnourished. Right. I mean, what we are doing to that island is evil.
And you know, Trump sold the idea of the Venezuela regime change as, a thrust for democracy. He quickly blurted out after it was over, it was all about oil. I mean, what do we get from Cuba? Sugar cane? I don't think we need that. We're responsible for it if we overthrow the government.
But here's the larger point, which mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about.
Sure.
I mean, and this is the problem of trying to develop foreign policy when we have a divided country, because, you know, you guys could get in and do a JCPOA and open up relations to Cuba, and the next guy comes in, yeah. Trump, and completely does away yeah. with it. And, you know, can you really have a stable foreign policy in this sort of environment where what one president does is going to be completely reversed by the next guy? And that's yeah. the nature of our politics. You know, one could argue that's why you need bipartisan support for anything you do on the foreign policy arena. I don't know that's what you want to hear, but
perspective. I agree with you that we look like a basket case to the world right now. It's Iran, it's Cuba, it's all kinds of issues. It's the whipsawing between Biden on Ukraine and Trump on Ukraine. We look crazy. We look like a completely unstable, unreliable ally, and people or our countries are turning away from us because of it. I think on Cuba specifically, I like, we tried 60 plus years of this stupid embargo. Let's try a different approach. And I would go back to the Obama policy of restoring diplomatic relations, opening embassies, getting rid of travel restrictions, trying to get money into the Cuban people's pockets through, you know, companies like Airbnb, right? We stay at a home. That was an end run around the Cuban state. More travel. Why was Cuba on the state sponsor of terrorism list? That's insane. What are we talking about? It's a joke. More flights. Like, let's just expand commercial relations and see if over time that could lead to some sort of broader political change within the country. Maybe it'll be failed too. And I know a bunch of super hardline Cubans in Miami who dream of getting, you know, property back and sort of running it back to how things were before the Castros came along, have a different approach. But I'd like to try something new. On your point though about, does all foreign policy have to be bipartisan? I just think we can't end up in that place. Like, winning a presidential election means you have certain authorities to conduct foreign policy. And I think presidents need to be able to run with that. I think we could talk about a whole set of broad systemic political reforms in this country that I'd love to see that would make us less insane, like getting rid of gerrymandering or money in politics or, you know, what have you. But it's like sort of a little afield for what you guys, I think, normally talk about.
What about in foreign policy? Do you see something that you would say, you know, not talking about political reform, but talking about, you know, constraints, authorities, anything that comes to mind that you would say, if we could change this, we wouldn't be so vulnerable to the kinds of changes Jeff was suggesting?
I mean, I think Congress needs to take back its authorities and start reminding people that it exists. And again, this is an area where it's like hands up. I think Obama, we bombed places in service of taking out Al-Qaeda affiliates in ways that I think was not intended by the original authorization for the use of military force after 9/11, right? Mm-hmm. I think the War Powers Act needs to be strengthened in some way so that you don't see these constant end runs around it. I mean, the Trump administration policy seems to be that you can just rename every military operation after 60 days and start the clock again. That's bonkers. I know every president since Nixon has said that the War Powers is unconstitutional, including the president I worked for, but we have to find a way that just creates more friction on presidents before they put service members in hostilities. I think that would be a great start.
I'm old enough to remember watching John F. Kennedy's inaugural address. If there is one line that anyone remembers from that address, it's, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Now, you as a master speechwriter for an American president, if you were the speechwriter for a new Democratic president, is there some version of that line that would rally Americans, you think? I don't mean to put you on the spot for an instant speech, but does something come to mind that could be a rallying point on foreign policy, national security for Americans today?
I don't know that I have like a great pitch at the moment for a line. I do think that what Americans want to hear is an optimistic, hopeful vision of the future and one that makes them feel good about America and the story of America, even while recognizing its imperfections and all the ways we've fallen short. I think if you're just constantly sounding hopeless or bleak or running down the country or criticizing it, people get angry and they want an alternative. We have to get back to a Kennedy-like vision that includes, I don't know, some sort of sense of shared sacrifice or collective support, care, feeding, service to the country. I think that would be incredibly valuable.
I think there is a similarity from that time to this in that Americans felt we were sort of against the ropes in 1960. You know, there was Sputnik, Soviet advances, the Soviet Union was on the march. We were feeling crowded and threatened. And I think probably with Iran and the rise of China and so on, there's a similarity between these between today and back in 1960.
Yeah. Well, that's a really interesting point. I do feel like I have some whiplash because in watching the 2024 campaign, it felt like one of the few areas of bipartisan agreement was about the threat from China. there was a lot of competition to see who would be the most hawkish and tough on China. And then in practice, Trump has kind of given up the farm. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like
he
has decided to fully sell out Taiwan. I don't really know what we got out of this last trip or what we even wanted to get. The trade war was lost within hours of it even starting. And so I don't want to get into a place where we are back into a Cold War framework where we do horrible things in Latin America, for example, in service of winning the Cold War. But I do think there is a way you could, I think, you know, drum up some nationalism and some competitive spirit in service of defeating China in some way.
Well, could you send us that speech tomorrow?
Yeah, we'll work on that. We'll get that sucker done.
Before we wrap up, we should go around the globe a little bit. Ukraine-Russia. What is the preferred democratic approach at this point to a war that does seem like a forever war at the moment?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think I would get back to a lot of the Biden policy on this. I mean, it seems like Trump has continued intelligence sharing, as far as I can tell, which is absolutely critical for these Ukrainians. I think I would try to focus as much as possible on specific coordination around drone technology and development, because that seems like a win-win and mutually beneficial for the U.S. And Ukraine, especially given all the challenges we're currently having in the wake of a couple of years of conflict with Iran about our stockpile of interceptor missiles. I think that Biden did a great job of like coordinating Europe and drumming up Ukrainian access to 155 millimeter shells and things of that nature. We should do more on deliveries of air defense munitions. But again, that's more complicated because those stockpiles got run down. I think bigger picture, I don't know why we're not doing more with the frozen Russian assets. It feels like Belgium is holding that up for like all of Europe and the US, and that seems crazy to me. I would try to get creative about a process for Ukrainian accession to the European Union. Right now, it's like jump through all these reform hoops and then you're in. Maybe there's a way to let them in and then create a process that goes down the reform route. I don't really think NATO is realistic when there's a war ongoing, but those conversations can continue.
I mean, look, all that sounds great, but I don't see how it leads to any kind of resolution of the core conflict that's going on.
Yeah, I don't either. And then, you know, you also have to have a pressure track on Russia, not just, you know, remove sanctions from the Russians because you're hoping to get more money into the markets because of the new war you started with Iran, or, you know, increase their revenue by starting another stupid war with Iran. I think the challenge with the Biden policy was it felt like endless feeding of weapons without any sort of diplomatic track that could lead to a resolution. I think Trump has put forward a diplomatic track. The problem is that it's a complete and total joke led by clowns like Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, who have been to Russia, what, like 8 times, and they've never even been to Ukraine. It's not an actual negotiation. It's those guys greasing future economic deals with the Russian oligarch in charge of their sovereign wealth fund, in my opinion. So, I think where Biden failed was not having talks with Russia, not having that diplomatic track going. So people felt like at least there was some process toward resolving it.
It seems to me, sorry if I sound like an old, really old line Cold War Democrat, but it seems to me with when you've got Finland, Sweden, and the Baltics digging trenches, so to speak, today, and great fear of a Russian territorial move on them, that a Democratic president or a candidate for president needs to say, we very firmly, we will not countenance a Russian invasion of any NATO state, period.
Yeah. Period. I mean, we should reassert our commitment to Article 5. But also, look, I recently went back because Ben Rhodes has a great new book out. You should check it out. I reread the FDR's Four Freedoms speech and Reagan's Evil Empire speech. Obviously, you know, very different people from different political perspectives, but both talked about shared values and a commitment to fighting fascism and the Nazis and autocracy. And it just made me think about how that kind of values-based foreign policy is kind of absent now. And I think we should get back to that. We obviously don't want to repeat the excesses of things the US did in service of winning the Cold War, but it does feel like we just no longer have any sort of values or consistency in our foreign policy in a way that is leading to more conflicts, not less.
You know, Tommy, one of the things that stands out when you say that is that, you know, you've referred many times during this conversation to mistakes that were made by the Biden administration and by the Obama administration. And I get the sense that you're not the only person that thinks that there were mistakes, that this is sort of a conversation that goes on among those who were in the room, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It might not, I mean, do you ever think about how, or do you think that that could be a constructive contribution that wouldn't, or is it so worrisome that that'll be used as political fodder against Democrats, is to say, look, we learned from our lessons. We have, so how is that playing out? Is there a conversation about that as, you know, trajectory of that?
I think the most of the stuff we do at Crooked Media, so I do a foreign policy show called Pod Save the World, and a Pod Save America is the political show. We try to draw from our experience and time in politics to, you know, provide analysis of things happening in the world. And a lot of that analysis is based around the fact that it's really easy to like take shots from the side, as I do now in my little podcast, but it's like very hard. It was very, very hard for, you know, Joe Biden to end the war in Ukraine, for example, right? And just to be honest about that. So yeah, we constantly talk about mistakes we made. We constantly talk about lessons learned from, you know, an overly militarized foreign policy, for example, and the inertia and the way the kind of DC permanent foreign policy class can push you towards more hawkish solutions. It's a very important thing, in my view.
And do you think that foreign policy leaders within the political conversation and the political leadership in the Democratic Party are listening and understand and can own that or not?
There's a lot of some yes, some no. I mean, there's a lot of muscle memory and scar tissue from the post 9/11 political fights. There's a lot of Democrats who talk and you kind of feel like it's 2003 or four again. Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of like need to throw as many adjectives and condemnations of various groups into the rhetoric and sound tough, even though like voters never end up feeling that way. But, you know, I think Obama course corrected on a bunch of stuff, but, you know, it was a different time.
Well, let's get a little personal on this score. I mean, among the people in National Security Action, one of the leaders is Jake Sullivan. He helped found it along with your partner, Ben Rhodes. And I know there's been a lot of blowback about the idea that Jake Sullivan should be part of the Democratic Party foreign policy establishment in waiting for the next Democratic Party president. How do you feel about that?
I think that President Biden made a series of catastrophic mistakes when it comes to the war in Gaza that hurt America's standing in the world, that dragged out the war, that led to more civilian deaths in Gaza, and that hurt his political standing. And I think there needs to be an accounting for that. Jake was obviously an important part of that team. I think he'll have to own those failures, and I think he does own those failures. I think the decision for whether or not to hire him to be part of that, you know, next administration, God willing that there is one, will be up to the president at the time, you know, who I think will take all these factors into consideration. So, I've seen
there's a lot of baggage there.
Yeah, there's a lot of baggage there. I get it. I understand the people who are angry and say, like, we need new voices, a next generation of leadership, new ideas. I think those are totally reasonable positions to take. But it's like, it's also a bit premature because I don't think Jake is angling for a job anywhere at the moment. I mean, as far as I know, there is, how about this? No such job exists at the moment.
Well, not for now.
Well, Tommy, thanks so much for spending time with us. Considering that you and your buddies, Jon Favreau and John Lovett, are play us, you know, you're still playing in the game and have immense followings and influence. So we wish you well, because I think you're a creative and imaginative and flexible thinker. And there's no small need for that in the Democratic Party. That's for sure.
Thank you all for having me on. We should fight about more things in the future. Maybe I feel like, Mike, I feel like this came about because you and I were barking at each other about
we had
the Saudis.
We had a Twitter spat on the Saudis, and we haven't even gotten to the Saudis. Next time.
Okay, we'll do it again. We'll run it back. So Ben and I will have you all on. We can fight about it.
I'm up for it.
All right, lovely.
That's great. Thanks, Tommy.
Thank you all. Talk soon.
So long. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.